Good afternoon. I am going to open up the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for Tuesday, March 24th. A couple of announcements first before we open up the first public hearing. We are still waiting for the paperwork on Senate Bill 193 and 194, and so everybody isn't waiting in anticipation of that. We're going to reschedule the work session for Tuesday, March 31st. So we're hoping, and I'm hoping that the legislative fiscal folks are listening, that we will have all our paperwork by next Tuesday, March 31st. So just wanted to make an announcement about that. Senate Bill 193 and 194 will be carried over till March 31st. Any other announcements, Beth?
No, I think that's everything.
Okay, so with that, we will open up our first public hearing. That's Senate Bill 513. I will open up a public hearing, and we'll ask Senator Devlin to come on up, please. And Beth, could you do a brief overview? And actually, we have Secretary of State Kate Brown that would like to come up and join him.
Senate Bill 513 establishes that it is the policy of the state to support the maintenance, enhancement, and restoration of ecosystem services, encourages state agencies to adopt and incorporate adoptive management mechanisms. So just for the record also, in the back of the room is an amendment, and also that's the one that we summarized, that replaces the text of the bill. And also there has been additional testimony that has been submitted for the record.
And that's been handed out to the committee members?
Yes, we have one packet that will be copied for everyone.
Okay. Thank you very much, Beth. Welcome, whoever would like to go first.
The Secretary of State has indicated she would like me to proceed first, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 513. I will be brief, as there are a number of experts in the room that will be better explain the bill that is before you. Senate Bill 513 does not make sweeping changes in Oregon statutes to regulate land and water use and management. It simply authorizes and encourages resource agencies and stakeholders to participate in a process hosted by the Sustainability Board to examine the critical issues associated with development and implementation of vibrant ecosystem service markets by convening a working group to make recommendations to the 2011 legislature. It is important to develop viable markets for the ecosystem services on lands, including carbon sequestration, clean and abundant water, clean air, fish and wildlife habitat, will help supplement traditional revenue sources and result in more economically viable economies. Senate Bill 513 will create a coordinated approach instead of having a random markets pop up and fade away without producing any tangible ecological and economic benefit. You also have dashed two amendments that add language that was excluded during the initial drafting of the bill. The amendment also cuts the fiscal from $250,000 to $120,000, and we are making efforts as we sit here today to cut it again and hopefully get it into a manageable number that we might have some chance of passage in this particular session. Oregon has been working to create policies necessary for effective ecosystem service marketplace. It is time that the legislature give some guidance and authorized coordination of these activities. I ask the committee for their support of 513.
Thank you, Senator. Secretary Brown.
Thank
welcome.
You. Good afternoon, committee members, Madam Chair. For the record, Kate Brown, Secretary of State. I was appointed by Governor Kulongowski to replace Secretary Bradbury in his role as chair of Oregon's Sustainability Board. Our mission in brief is to leverage and promote sustainability throughout the state of Oregon. The Sustainability Board is, overwhelming in support of Senate Bill 513 and encourages your passage. I have not yet had the opportunity to actually chair the meeting. Our first meeting will be Friday that I'll get to chair. I think it's extremely important for the legislature to make a policy statement to encourage state agencies to continue breaking down jurisdictional boundaries. I think your leadership on this issue will encourage risk-taking by state agencies on the creation of eco-market systems. I encourage your support. Happy to have Senator Devlin answer any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions for either of the two distinguished guests here? I think they're letting you off. I think they're letting you off easy. Thank you very much
Thank
for
you.
Coming to support this bill.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I will call up Hal Salwasser from Oregon State University and Gail Achterman.
Go first.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. I'm Hal Salwasser. I'm the Dean of the College of Forestry and Director of the Oregon Forest Research Laboratory at Oregon State University. And I'm here today to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 513 as a private citizen, one who knows a few things about forests and their many values for the quality of human life, including the livability of our planet. Senate Bill 513 represents an excellent starting point in the process to engage the private sector more effectively in conservation activities than regulations alone can accomplish, and if this legislation is approved and properly implemented, it could eventually lead to rewards for private landowners who take specific steps to provide essential ecosystem services to the public. To the extent that these markets develop for ecosystem services, the potential exists for landowners to supplement their income from crops and timber with revenues from the sale of carbon, habitat, wetland, water quality, and other kinds of ecosystem credits. This diversification of incentives would be a powerful signal for people to keep their forest lands and forest uses rather than convert them to non-forest uses and have them simultaneously producing the food, fiber, and ecosystem services that our daily living depends on. The Institute for Natural Resources is proposed as a place to do some studies. I think this is most appropriate. They have hosted a number of dialogues about ecosystem service metrics, economics, policies, and implementation strategies, and it makes perfect sense for them to manage the work proposed in the legislation. And I just say, as an aside, one of the more vexing challenges in the emergence of these markets is to find a scientifically defensible way to account for the carbon that would be stored in forests and forest products. And we've got some faculty in conjunction with the federal forest scientists in Corvallis who are working on a web-accessible, user-friendly tool so that landowners and brokers could do that kind of accounting with the sorts of inventories that they would have at hand. I'll be pleased to take any questions from the committee.
Okay, we'll hear from Ms. Ackerman first and then see if there's any questions.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, thank you for holding the hearing on Senate Bill 513. I'm here also as a private citizen to testify in favor of the legislation.
And Gail, can you state your name again, please?
It's Gail Achterman, and I'm the director of the Institute for Natural Resources, which is a multi-campus university research institute administered by Oregon State University, and I also chair the Oregon Transportation Commission. And what I wanted to share with you today is really some of my experience with ecosystem service markets and ecosystem service market development and why I think this legislation is critically important. In 2008, the INR Advisory Board, which represents a wide range of state and local government and business and nonprofit and academic experts, they identified ecosystem service policy as a key challenge and opportunity facing Oregon and really felt that we should make it a priority. And their advice did match my own experience, underscoring the importance of using ecosystem market-based approaches. The two examples that I have the greatest experiences with are when I was executive director of the Deschutes River Conservancy in Central Oregon, we used an ecosystem service market approach to develop water markets to restore stream flows in the Deschutes Basin. That effort started in a very preliminary stage in 2000, and now, less than 9 years later, over 100 cubic feet per second of flows have been restored in the upper critical reaches of the Deschutes River, which have provided aquatic habitat and recreational benefits. And at the same time, they have allowed the existing holders of water rights to be compensated for the use of those water rights, some of whom would have been at risk of losing their rights or losing their farms if they hadn't been able to lease the water rights in stream. So as Dr. Salwasser said, this is a really important tool for both environmental restoration and for maintaining the vitality of our rural private landowners. The other experience that I've had, and Margie Livesay from the Oregon Department of Transportation is here and will be able to testify in more detail, is the use that ODOT made of ecosystem service markets to expedite project delivery for the Oregon Bridge Program. The Institute for Natural Resources actually wrote a case study of that, and that program is a national model for transportation agencies on how to reduce costs, reduce time, and improve environmental outcomes in delivering transportation infrastructure to Oregonians. The key to success in developing ecosystem service markets, whether it's a non-governmental organization like the Deschutes River Conservancy or whether it's a state agency like the Oregon Department of Transportation that wants to utilize such markets, or whether it's a private developer, is getting all of the state and federal permitting and regulatory agencies to agree on desired outcomes and performance measures. You've got to agree on what are the units of exchange in the market that you're trying to achieve. Senate Bill 513 will create the work group needed to pull all these organizations together. And without legislative policy direction and without some support for such a work group, frankly, business as usual is likely to continue, which costs time, money, and delivers poorer environmental outcomes. So I think this bill provides the focus that's necessary to take Oregon to a national leadership level in ecosystem service market implementation. I believe that most of you have received copies, and we can get them for you online and give you the links to the policy cornerstones on ecosystem service markets and action strategies that the Institute for Natural Resources worked on with a number of other partners that lays out a work plan to how to get to where we want to go. And I think that if the bill is passed, INR can leverage other resources and past work that we're doing and current work that we're doing with other funding to staff the work group and provide very cost-effective work product to achieve the policy objective that hopefully the legislature will embrace. And I also would be happy to answer any questions.
Great, thank you. Any questions for this panel? Okay, I think you guys got off easy. Thanks for coming here today.
You don't want to know about carbon offset crediting metrics?
I was going to ask it, but I'm afraid that we are going to run out of time.
I don't think it's germane to our topic right now.
I'd still be a no vote regardless.
Okay, Bobby Cochran, Sarah Vickerman, and Chris Charmer. Hello. Why don't you get started, Sarah?
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Vickerman. I'm the director of the Northwest Office for Defenders of Wildlife, which is located in West Lynn. And we have been involved in the development of this bill since the time that the policy dialogue took place about a year ago that Gail mentioned, and we gave you copies of the report for a little light bedtime reading. Anyway, what this bill is intended to do is be a first step to enable and encourage agencies in Oregon to participate in the development and management of markets for ecosystem services in Oregon. Ecosystem services, as you know, because others have mentioned it, include this broad spectrum of benefits from the natural environment, like carbon sequestration, clean air, clean water, fish and wildlife habitat, and that sort of thing. So specifically, what this bill does is to establish a state policy to support the maintenance and enhancement of these ecosystem services across all ownerships. It encourages the state to use ecosystem markets to meet some of its environmental and economic goals, and it authorizes the use of adaptive management. Why, you ask, should it do that? Well, apparently adaptive management is not authorized in Oregon law. The Department of Justice told us in this forum that the report summarizes, so we've included that in there, too. It's an important part of this process.
As you know, it directs the Sustainability Board to potentially contract with the Institute for Natural Resources to manage a work group that will come back to you with a report in 2011 and deal with issues like what are the overarching goals for ecosystem markets, what entities ought to be involved in their creation and management, how do we develop consistent methodologies for measuring these services to make it easier for buyers and sellers to participate. What role should the government have in these markets as opposed to the private sector? And to what policies do we need to stimulate the demand for ecosystem service markets in Oregon? So the reason the bill is necessary, there are a couple of reasons, Senator Devlin mentioned one primary one, that the legislature really has not dealt with this issue at all. And so this is just the beginning. It's not the end of the policy issues. And beyond that, however, we are concerned that in the absence of a policy from the legislature and some work in the interim, that the tendency for each agency to develop its own program with a separate set of rules and administrative requirements would happen in silos, and they would raise the administrative costs for both buyers and sellers to the point that the market would not be viable either ecologically or economically. So that's the primary reason. So there are many, many benefits here, potentially better ecological results at a lower cost, more effective use, more strategic use of the existing funds, green jobs, diversified income for landowners, savings to industry and local government, expedited development in the places where development should occur. So I believe you have the packet with some letters of support from quite a diverse group of interests. I won't go through those because you already have them. And just a note on the fiscal impact. As Senator Devlin told you, we're working with the Institute for Natural Resources to get the actual cost of this down to the lowest possible amount by leveraging funds from other sources for similar work that the Institute is doing. But beyond that, the agencies are already involved in these negotiations for these measuring ecosystem services and dealing with the policy issues. So the work group would simply be a continuation of the work that the agencies are already doing and involvement of the people in the private sector who are interested in getting involved. So that's all I have.
Great. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you. I do have one quick question before we move on to the other witnesses. Is can you talk about other states or other parts of the country where this is happening? I certainly know that there's a couple of examples here in Oregon, that one in the Willamette River, and of course we've heard about the Deschutes. But can you talk about other states and if there's similar legislation that's been adopted?
I can address part of that, and maybe Bobby can pick up the other part of it. I am not aware of any other similar legislation in other states, and I think that, but there we, all of us at the table, and many of the people we've heard here today, keep in very close contact with people in other states. In fact, there's some organized efforts to coordinate the activities across state lines in North Carolina, Virginia, particularly Maryland, Ohio, Washington, California. There's some other similar activities, but I think most agree that the work of the Willamette Partnership in Oregon is about the most advanced, along with a similar project called the Bay Bank in the Chesapeake region with Washington, Virginia, and Maryland. So Bobby can tell you probably more than you ever want to know about these specific things going on in other states.
Okay, Bobby, why don't you go ahead and make sure to introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Bobby Cochran. I'm with Clean Water Services. Thank you for having me. I'll spare you everything I know on that one. But I think Sarah's exactly right, that Oregon is being looked to throughout the Northwest and the country as being a leader in these ecosystem markets. And what we're proposing here is not without precedent, but certainly would establish us and continue to establish us as a leader. But I'm here today really as for Clean Water Services as well as on behalf of the Willamette Partnership. Clean Water Services is a county special service district providing water resource services to over 500,000 residents in Washington County and small parts of Clackamas and Multnomah counties. We provide wastewater and stormwater services, but we're also working with regional partners to lead the Tuolumne and Basin Water Supply Project, working to bring additional sources of water. In 2004, Clean Water Services, working closely with EPA, Department of Environmental Quality, the Farm Bureau, and our local Soil and Water Conservation District, really worked actively to explore a water quality trading program in Washington County. And basically, that program was one of the first of its kind in the country and allowed us to basically work with farmers to plant trees, and we were able to meet our water quality needs as well as lots of other environmental needs. And basically, the traditional approach to meeting our water quality permits under that scenario would have cost our ratepayers about $150 million in concrete and steel to chill our effluent, releasing it into the Tualatin River. But that isn't what our watershed needed. It needed focused investments in green infrastructure. It needed cooperative efforts between working farms and cities. It needed a new approach. And basically, because of trading, instead of $150 million, we spent $6 million to restore 35 miles of stream in areas that were once, you know, invasive species where nothing had grown. Now they're 10 feet tall trees with cutthroat trout and river otter running through it. And basically, we're working with EPA, DEQ, and the Farm Bureau in ways that we never would have been able to do otherwise. And in the last 5 years, the Willamette Partnership, a public-private coalition, has implemented market approaches throughout the Willamette to increase the pace, scope, and effectiveness of restoration, and in a way that really goes about providing new jobs and new income opportunities. University of Oregon research found that of 80 cents on every dollar spent on restoration stays in the county. 96 cents on every dollar spent on restoration stays in Oregon. Of a restoration, for every $1 million that's spent on restoration, 28 to 13 new jobs are created. For every $1 million spent, we get $2 to $4 million in economic benefit coming back to the state of Oregon. And so these ecosystem markets are not only an important way to go about getting our environmental needs, they're a really important kind of pillar of this new green economy, an economy that is Oregon has a unique comparative advantage in. And SB 513 really goes about encouraging and authorizing state agencies to work on some of those market forces to make sure that Oregon stays as a leader, takes advantage of that economic opportunity. And so we're here really strongly encouraging adoption. And on behalf of Clean Water Services, thank you very much. And Oregon is at a really exciting juncture, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, great. Any questions, Bobby? All right, thank you. Chris.
Madam Chair, members, Chris Sharmer, Oregon Forest Industries Council, here in support of 513. Just as you know, OFIC represents over 5 million acres of forest land in the state, so it's a pretty significant piece of property. Just kind of put some context on this. In late 2008, when the debate was whether we were entering a recession or not, we kind of chuckled to ourselves. We were already entrenched in a recession. And the question for us was whether it was going to turn into a depression. And I think as 2009 wears on, we're going to find the answer to that question is yes for the timber industry. When the economy returns for the rest of the sectors, it'll take a while to generate demand for the product that we provide, and that'll just keep us in this trough of prices for even a longer amount of time. As you know, that pressure leads some people to want to change the use of their land, and the only profitable use conversion is to convert to development, and that's not something that I don't think anybody wants to see. So given all of that, when you're in a situation like this as a business, you look to either increase revenues or cut costs, and I think the cost cutting is pretty much done. Those of us that are few that survive are hanging on for dear life. So the other answer is to increase revenues, and that's what ecosystem markets are all about, and finding a non-traditional way to increase revenues to the landowners. So that's it in a nutshell, and we're excited that there's some potential out there to keep our people on the ground and keep those forests in forest use where everybody wants them to be. So with that simple testimony, I'd take any questions.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, John Charles and David Ford. Okay. John, why don't you go first?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute. And we are a market-oriented research center, and so any bill that says it's interested in promoting markets, we generally tend to get interested in. And I personally started my career 30 years ago with Environmental Defense Fund, one of the most market-oriented of the national environmental groups, and so I have thought a lot about this, and I support the general thrust of the bill. But I'm not sure that the exact wording of the bill necessarily moves us in the right direction, and I want to point out a couple potential problems. Actually, there are a number of definitional problems, I think, in the first four definitions, which I'm going to skip over for now. But line 15 and 16, where it on page 1, where
John,
it defines...
John, are you looking at the bill or the dash 2s?
Just the bill. I don't have the amendments.
Okay, because the definitions change in the amendment.
Because at least... Okay. Does
maybe
it,
we
does
can
it
make
still
sure
include ecosystem services as a, including regulatory and quasi-regulatory?
No.
Okay.
Oh, yes, it does under the market, but not under the definition of ecosystem services. So you may want to take a look at those
Thanks.
Definitions.
The full, lines 16 on the dash 2, spectrum of regulatory, quasi-regulatory, and voluntary markets. That's... Generally speaking, I tend to think that a regulatory market is mostly not a market. You're being forced into something. Now, if you're being forced into it because the regulation is internalized in legitimate externality, correcting what is essentially a nuisance problem, and your response to that engages in ecosystem services, that's legitimate. But there is a trend now, it's especially prominent in global warming discussions, to... create a regulation, call it market-based, but really it's designed to create value sort of out of thin air in this cap-and-trade program. That's it's a contrived market. It's not a true market, and I'm not sure that people are going to get much in return. And so when you define ecosystem services to include the voluntary, quasi-regulatory, and regulatory market, you need to be careful about what you're encouraging there. My second concern has to do with in the dash 2, I'm not sure I immediately see whether it says that this is necessary, but I just want to point out I don't actually think the intervention is necessary. We've had a thriving ecosystems market for well over 100 years, both in Oregon and elsewhere. Just a quick inventory of ones, just so you know, that's been going on. You know, Sea Lions Caves is probably the most prominent example of private land that was purchased from the government in 1887 and then repurchased by another party in 1927, where three people put everything they had of their equity into creating a business to protect habitat for sea lions that continues to be commercially successful. At the exact same time, the state of Oregon was paying people $5 bounty to kill sea lions. The ecosystem services market, the voluntary market, was way ahead of the curve in recognizing value, because sea lions at the time were considered to be salmon-chomping nuisances that the state wanted to exterminate. So I think that's a great example, and there are many others. Of course, it raises the issue of which is better, sea lions or salmon, and there's no scientific answer to that. It depends on what you care about. That's a completely human value. Other quick examples, the park blocks in Portland, donated by private developers. Hundreds, if not thousands, of hunting and fishing clubs here and in England and other countries, where people put their own money on the line to buy up habitat and manage it to protect it. Nature Conservancy was an early pioneer in the land trust movement that now has hundreds or thousands of land trusts doing the same thing. The Oregon Water Trust was an early pioneer, and then later the one that Gail Achterman mentioned, Chutes River Conservancy, pioneers in water trading. And more recently, electric utilities in Oregon have become national leaders in green power programs, where people voluntarily choose to pay maybe $15 extra a month to basically, they don't really get anything in return. They support sort of the existence value of some amorphous green power value. And among the 600 or so utilities in the country that run green power programs, PP&L and PGE are routinely in the top 10, if not the top 5, in the country. And people, it's completely voluntary that they pay for this ecosystem service. Now, unfortunately, those early voluntary programs are disallowed under Senate Bill 838, the RPS law you passed last session, but they are commendable green power programs. And so I guess my moving to my final comments, I'm not sure, when you get into regulatory ecosystem markets and you promote them, We already know, for instance, from the 1997 law that mandated a CO2 compliance law for electric utilities that's 17% below what they can what anybody can meet, so you force them to pay money to the Climate Trust. We've recently done an audit of every trade the Climate Trust has done. We published it, and it turns out that a lot of people who sent money to the Climate Trust did not get the offsets they were promised. But it's a compliance market. It was a shakedown scheme. They said they sent the check. They're out of the loop. They have no incentive to follow up on it. I don't think that's the kind of market that you want to promote. I actually think, I'm not even sure that we need a law. I think you may actually need to fix some laws that we already have. For instance, I think it would be great if the state would take the lead in trying to talk to our congressional delegation about reforming the Endangered Species Act. I mean, if your goal is to punish private landowners for almost any good deed for habitat improvement, the ESA is a great law for doing that. Be great to reform that. The Betsy program under consideration right now in various committees, you're spending huge amounts of money subsidizing big wind developers who don't need the subsidy, and it helps promote the renewable energy credit market, the green tag market, but if you're interested in migratory birds, big wind farms aren't such a great thing. So you have a conflict between these things, RECs, green tags, birds. Well, we're subsidizing the destruction of birds, and I think you ought to seriously consider cutting back subsidies to the wind farms. And the third thing, final thing I'll say is, you know, half of Oregon, more than half of Oregon, is owned by the federal government. And because it's public lands, it suffers from the tragedy of the commons. We all own the public lands. Therefore, none of us own the public lands. Well, in the absence of property rights of some kind, you can't really run ecosystem services. You know, when water trading, those kinds of things, there have to be property rights. More than half the state doesn't have property rights. So it defaults to the lowest common denominator of political control of public lands. And what you get on much of them is they sit around waiting to be torched off in the next catastrophic wildfire. And where do you go from there? I don't think that's in anybody's best interest. I think we need to have some creative approaches to reforming the more than half of Oregon that is in public ownership to create something approximating property rights so you can actually engage in the market-based mechanisms you're talking about. And if we took the lead here through you or through the governor's office to begin doing that with our federal land managers, that'd be a great step forward. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is David Ford. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. The mission of Oregon Small Woodlands is to provide opportunities to small family forest landowners across the state. And one such opportunity is payment for ecosystem services that are provided by families that result from sustainable forest management activities. So I'm here today to support SB 513. One challenge that our state faces is the loss of forest lands, as you've heard other witnesses talk today about, including land that is owned by nearly 70,000 family forest landowners across the state. There are a lot of reasons for the loss of forest land, including conversion to other uses and development, in part because it's getting harder and harder to maintain these lands and forests when faced with the values available for other land uses, especially in the kind of markets we see today. So today, our only real option for sustained income is to sell our trees, and most family forest landowners will continue to do so as a primary source of income. However, diversification of income from our lands is an important and a very exciting opportunity. The prospect of receiving yearly income for providing voluntary, valuable ecosystem services will help improve our chances of keeping family forest lands in forests. Last year, the Oregon Small Woodlands Association created a new company called Woodlands Carbon. The new company is designed to aggregate carbon being stored on family forest lands across the state. It will sell carbon on the voluntary marketplace, either through the Chicago Climate Exchange or directly with local companies. We hope we can use this model to sell other ecosystem services in the future, all for the purpose of increasing and diversifying income to family forest landowners so they can keep their lands in forest. I want to thank you for the opportunity to share our thoughts and be happy to keep you informed about how our efforts are on actually using a marketplace to sell carbon stored on family woodlands in the future, and I'd be pleased to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions for either two of the witnesses? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, and last up is Margie Livesay. I get that right, Margie, and Catherine Vanetta. Margie, why don't you go first since you signed up first?
Hi, thank you, Senator Dielfinger and the committee. My name is Margie Livesay, and I'm the Sustainability Program Manager for ODOT. We don't support or against this bill, of course, but I'm here to speak on behalf of the agency on our experience, our successful experience with ecosystem markets and how it could in the long run benefit the agency. Currently, our standard practice or the standard practice for permitting a project, whether it's maintenance or highway bridge, project would be to go through the permitting process, and there's several different statutes that apply, you know, Section 401 of the Clean Water Act, 404, the Endangered Species Act, the, you know, potentially Clean Air Act, and so we would look at those all individually and then work with the agencies individually, and then if there's impacts, mitigate for those individually. And what has resulted over time is a very piecemeal approach on how we do mitigation to our impacts to the environment. So imagine up and down a corridor, take I-5 corridor, there's small piecemeal mitigation projects. And what we see this bill doing is providing us an opportunity to look at mitigating holistically, providing more benefits to the environment, while really being able to kind of streamline our process. And as Gail Ackerman mentioned, we did this in the OTIA Bridge Project, which basically set up a mitigation bank, much like this proposes to do, where all the agencies agreed that we could mitigate for our bridge, our impacts from our bridges, by giving money to a mitigation bank. Someone else set it up and protected in a complete ecosystem. And our return on investment, later we did a cost-benefit analysis of the OTIA Bridge project, was that we saved, it was $3.19 per dollar saving, because that's just saving of administrative cost, our own time, and then, of course, monitoring in the long term. So, in short, we think this would be a win-win both for the agency and for the environment. Lastly, I do want to note that there is some restrictions for ODOT's participation because of the Highway Trust Fund. We cannot purchase land up front to offer other people for credits. We could buy for credits, but I just want to note that we are aware of our restrictions and the use of money through the Highway Trust Fund.
Thank you. Catherine?
Chair Dingfelter, members of the committee, Catherine Vanetta, Governmental Affairs Manager of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. The Northwest Pulp and Paper Association has long been involved in matters of water quality. And we have comments today on the late-breaking amendments and the concept of 513. Because of our work in water quality, we're well aware of the Water Quality Standards Program and how that works. Our facilities are regulated under the Clean Water Act, and we hold NPDES permits that comply with all aspects of the water quality standards. And we've here today, I hear that this bill is to talk about trading. And the position of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association is that in matters of compliance with the Clean Water Act and our water quality permits, that we should not be pushed into trading as a mechanism of compliance with our permits. And I have examples in this bill where we're fearful of the word regulatory being mentioned a few too many times as a way of setting a standard that would then require perhaps trading or other methods of compliance, which in actuality takes money that we could be investing in our facility and would transfer it to other landowners or non-point source facilities and issues like this. It's a very complicated situation, and I ask that you bear with me as I perhaps go through some scenarios of how we would see this perhaps happening. On page one of the amendments dated 312, we have the including on line 16, we have including the full spectrum of regulatory, quasi-regulatory, and voluntary markets. Today, we do not rise in opposition to any voluntary markets. What we rise in opposition to is regulatory-based markets that either set caps or that set standards that are unachievable through the use of technology that's currently available and is cost-effective for use of treatment of water. Going on to page 3 of the amendments, lines 9 and 10, this is section 3.5, we have the new or improved regulatory schemes and increased public awareness will make additional natural resources available to protect and enhance ecosystem services. The newer enhanced regulatory schemes, we are not sure what those would necessarily be, but the regulation will certainly have a cost more than likely to someone if it's mandatory regulation. And again, on page 4, lines 28 to 30, this is section 5.2F, proposed potential policies to help stimulate demand for payments for ecosystem services, in particular the development of regulatory and voluntary ecosystem service markets. And to the extent that this bill proposes that there should be regulatory markets created, I would ask in this economic time that perhaps we clarify what is meant by regulatory created markets or quasi-regulatory created markets for the fact that when we're talking about the trading of services and that, we're also talking about the transfer of money. And when we talk about water quality trading, as the example that I would like to use, DEQ is currently considering revising its toxics water quality standards to some of the most stringent toxics water quality standards in the country. And if we were to install treatment to meet those standards, it would be cost prohibitive for us to do so. We have the engineering studies to back this up. And if we were to do that, we would not be able to operate because the cost of installing the treatment would be far more than actually the book value of our facilities at the current time in these market conditions. And even if we weren't in these market conditions, they would still be more expensive than some that have sold at auction in bankruptcy lately. And so when you combine that issue, what we are told by the government agencies which regulate us is that trading is a way to comply with the standards, that you could trade. And certain aspects of things that we know we have trouble with in Oregon with water quality standards are naturally occurring earth metals. Our naturally occurring earth metals, because of our volcanic soils, are in abundance here. And they are above the standards just at natural background. In some instances, you'll actually be talking about one in your upcoming hearings, and that's the earth metal of arsenic. And the water quality standard is actually far below the drinking water standard, which is at the drinking water standard is 10 micrograms per liter. The water quality standard in Oregon is 0.02 micrograms per liter. And so when you combine these things and we're trying to figure out how we're actually going to comply, we're told, well, you can trade. And we're not quite sure how trading would work for an industrial facility as it has worked for facilities like a municipal utility, perhaps. We think that the industrial sector that supports your main jobs and provides your jobs and is the powerhouse of your economy would probably be challenged in court. on matters of water quality trading. And we don't have a proven issue in Oregon where an industrial facility has traded on a conserved pollutant. So we would ask that you proceed with caution and fully look at your creation of regulatory markets in connection with this bill and think about the train as it's leaving the station and actually what you want to support. And like I would like to reiterate, we do not have any issues with voluntary markets. We have issues with markets that would be created by regulatory mechanisms where compliance would be either the technology is not available or it would be cost prohibitive to install. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for either of these panel members? Okay. Thank you. And last up, Jim Welsh. Is there anybody else who didn't sign up that would like to come testify in this bill? Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, Jim Welsh representing Oregon Cattlemen. Not here to support having just opened up the dash tubes, but to make some comments and ask or raise some questions, I would say. I think there's some things in some comments in here and some language that we would definitely agree with. And under Section 3, we have maintained for a long time as cattle producers, and we're talking about a lot of acreage, especially, thinking about a number of the landscapes in eastern Oregon. And a lot of these ranches are in thousands of acres. And we have maintained for a long time that these ranches that have been passed through generation and generation have been sustained by the practices that they've been involved with. And we call those best practices. Not to say that the new science that's being used in the consideration and the emphasis on ecological science that we have today hasn't changed their practices, because it has. And they are today involving themselves more and more. And I have a great CD that I'd like to share with you, and I'll bring them by your offices. And we talk about where a lot of our producers are today involving themselves in these service markets. They're already very much alive and mitigating some of the problems on the ground that the owners recognize themselves. And they would have to, because they're involved with thousands of acres and many hours of travel, maybe on horseback, ATV, or by foot, investigating, you know, the streams that run through their properties, you know, the natural habitat that they're supporting, a lot of the wildlife in the state. And so these are considerations that go through their minds day after day after day. And when we get over here to section B, into section 5 and 6, and no, it'll be under section 3, 5, and 6, and then starting on section 4, we got some questions here. It would be under section 4, sub 2. It says state agencies are encouraged to use ecosystem services markets as a means to meet mitigation needs. Well, first of all, we'd look at that and go, that would probably and could be positive, because we work with Fish and Wildlife, Department of Agriculture, and DEQ in mitigating some things on our properties that we have identified as needing some work. Okay, riparian areas, stream bank mitigation, and other things that I can think of. But then, you know, we're talking about then back to section 3, sub 5, and 6. We're talking more about regulation and a little bit of contradiction there between 5 and 6. New or approved regulatory schemes and increased public awareness will make additional natural resources available to protect and enhance ecosystem services. And we're talking down here about not needing more regulatory schemes necessary in the service markets here. And so we would naturally assume that more agency oversight, or it could be defined as intrusion, will lead to need for or requirement of mitigation. And that's where we pause. I know our producers out there, as they travel their properties, they understand what has occurred naturally and what needs to be mitigated. And so many times they bring in agencies to help them. And so some of this is definitely working, but if it's going to require that we have to have more regulatory intrusion, I would say that they would stop in supporting this type of action, because it's occurring, and it's occurring naturally. And I think they, as an industry, are moving much faster than a lot of people really recognize. But I think there's some positive things in here, but we want to study this. And having just looked at this, I just want to raise some of those considerations, knowing some of my clients and the questions they'd raise. But we would like to also be involved in anything further that's done, if there's a work group or anything else that's involved in this.
Okay. All
thank
right.
you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Welch? Okay, thank you. And you probably know there's no work session today, so you'll have some more time to study it. Anybody else like to testify in this bill? Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 513. Thank you very much for coming today, and go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 675. And Beth, if you can give us an overview on the bill, please.
Senate Bill 675 requires county governing bodies and city councils to adopt and implement solar access ordinances, requires that the ordinances provide protection for existing solar devices from structures being developed or vegetation being planted or grown, requires that solar access protection ordinances be adopted and implemented within 1 year of the act taking effect. And there was also some additional testimony that was submitted that is also in your packet.
Okay, and Senator Przanski, since your name is on this bill, do you want to say a few words?
Sure, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and committee members, 675 is a constituent bill. A person that lives in my district, Robert Ball, lives in the Cottage Grove area but outside the city, brought it to my attention that on his property where he resides, he had placed solar access collectors, and a neighbor who purchased after he did and or may have been the owner prior to that but had no activity of any type of development at the location on their side of the property line, decided to plant a line of trees that as they are grown will in fact shade out his ability to use his solar collectors. He brought it to my attention and asked if I would be willing to introduce a bill on his behalf, which I have done. And based on his description, it seems like there was really no reason except for that the individual on the other side of the fence decided that he just wanted to put the trees there and knew that there was a solar collectors on that other side just to, let's say, not be a good neighbor. At least that's the impression I got. So I understand, unfortunately, in my office, I believe, dropped the ball, no pun intended, to get hold of Robert Ball. And so he is not here today. So that's what the purpose of the bill is. And I understand from looking at the sign-up sheet, there's four organizations that represent different groups that are here to give us their perspective of why 675 shouldn't go forward as it is drafted.
Okay. So with that, Dan Eisenbeis and Martha Pellegrino, why don't you come up? You can share with us your thoughts on this bill. I'm sure you have some. Martha, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martha Pellegrino, representing the City of Portland. City of Portland, I'm just going to make a few actually very brief comments on the record, and then I believe Daniel will go a little bit deeper into some of these issues. But the City of Portland supports the intent of Senate Bill 675. We understand that a number of businesses and individuals were making significant investments in solar energy and renewable energy, and we want to ensure that those investments are protected. Moreover, the city views solar energy technology as one component of a comprehensive strategy to meet our greenhouse gas reduction goals. However, as drafted, the bill raises some concerns. First and foremost, extending the solar access provision to structures could both be difficult to implement and could come into conflict with other city policy by limiting height, bulk, and density beyond the limits established by zoning. It grants solar devices greater relative importance than other desired outcomes, such as compact urban density and improvement to the urban forest canopy. Second, there's concern that the one-year implementation date in this bill would not be feasible, particularly given budget cuts faced by state and local governments. Thirdly, some of the language in the bill would benefit from some additional clarification. For example, it's unclear what is meant by existing solar devices in lines 9 and 26. For this committee's information, the City of Portland currently does have a solar access permit that I believe dates back to the 1980s that is limited to vegetation. But at this point, I do not believe anyone has availed themselves of applying for such a permit. I can say that the City's Planning Sustainability Bureau has been working on updating the policy and intends to do outreach to the public, but it is due to come before City Council in the fall. So it's certainly something that we are anticipating and an issue we're looking at, but at this point we are not at the point to make a strong recommendation. So I guess in conclusion, I would say that this may well be the direction that the City of Portland intends to go on this issue, but it's going to take some working through some of the issues, particularly relating to structures and development relating to building and density. So we would look forward to working with this committee on this bill to make legislation that meets the intent but is also workable for the city. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, Dan.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeiss with the League of Oregon Cities. I would just like to make a few comments about existing statute and the layout of this bill. As existing statute, which is contained in this bill, acknowledges, the idea of a solar access ordinance involves quite a bit of complexity as tailored to local conditions, be it topography, weather, physical geography, or the built environment. And it's our belief that the current statutory language permitting cities and counties to adopt solar access ordinances provides very good guidance as to what shall be considered in providing and protecting, to the extent feasible, solar access on the south side of buildings. Right now, cities, like many other levels of government, are facing budgetary challenges, and many cities are being forced to look at or already have laid off city planners. So when one considers the complexity of these sorts of ordinances, we see this as a significant unfunded mandate. I've passed around a copy of the Ashland Solar Access Ordinance just to give you a sense of what these ordinances may involve. That's 9 pages long. It includes multiple algebraic formula. And it also acknowledges that in some cases, as Martha alluded, there are competing goals at the local level as we seek to promote sustainability and reduction of greenhouse gases. It's desirable to both encourage renewable production but also to encourage compact development that reduces the need for energy and carbon-based fuels. And those two may come into conflict. It's the League's belief that that juggling or balancing act is best addressed at the local level. Specifically, in addition to the change in the bill from allowing these ordinances to be adopted to instructing that they shall be adopted, looking at the additional prescriptive language, there are a number of concerns and questions that come up for the League. If one compares the new language to the immediately preceding sentence, there are multiple differences, such as alluding to the ordinance versus alluding to the City Council. Language saying provide and protect to the extent feasible versus language saying provide protection. I think the courts would be forced to delineate some sort of difference in between the two sentences in terms of the terms that are used. It's unclear what the intent is there. It would be our suggestion that in providing such guidance that perhaps we clarify that, given the current statutory language, that protecting to the extent feasible solar access is meant to be ongoing solar access. It's important that certain considerations be taken into account rather than providing a prescriptive measure for exactly what the ordinances must perform. If you look at the Ashland ordinance, specifically to section 18.70.080, the hearing procedures, it includes a couple clauses for the possibility of objections and denial of a permit based upon vegetation, or specifically if you look at number 3 there, if the application would unreasonably restrict development of the objector's presently underdeveloped property, that may be grounds for rejection. I'm not pointing to that as a suggestion for what should be in statutory language, but it's an example of how one local community has chosen to try to provide some balance to what could be considered equally a reasonable investment-backed expectations. So with that, I'll close my comments, but I would just encourage the committee to approach this as something best addressed at the local level and making sure that we're providing good guidance to communities rather than requiring that they take upon work that they may not be able to afford or that may force them into making decisions that conflict with other goals that they have before them. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yep.
Senator Brzezinski.
Martha, regarding the permitting that the city of Portland has, if someone did get a permit, what would that allow them to do? Would that give them safe haven to know that someone couldn't put some type of at least vegetation structure that would basically undo their investment?
Madam Chair and Senator Brzezinski, it's a very good question, and I don't have the ordinance in front of me. My understanding of it is that if someone has an issue with their neighbor with regard to vegetation, they may have the ability to go to the city and apply for a permit to address that. To address the vegetation under essentially a nuisance type law, and that then the city could take action to require the neighbor to address that issue. Since it is not actually ever, no one's ever actually applied for that permit, I can't say in practice how that would go, but I could certainly be happy to provide you with more details about what the current process is. Again, I would say that it is being seriously looked at to be updated in the city. There's a citywide tree policy that's going to be coming before the council, probably making some new recommendations about how to update that.
So in other words, what I'm hearing is it's basically investor beware. If you're planning on putting solar collectors in the city of Portland, there is no safeguard or safe haven to know that your neighbor couldn't put vegetation that would impact the ability to recoup your investment.
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, since there is a current ordinance or there is something currently in code, I would not say that it's buyer beware. I would say that there is a process in place. It just hasn't been used, and I would have to follow up with you to provide you some more details about what process that would be.
It would be great to see. I mean, it's kind of interesting. You have an ordinance but don't know what the ordinance actually provide for.
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, I do know that it's in code, and unfortunately I don't have that information with me today.
That's the problem, it's in code. I'm trying to figure out what the code is.
Right, and I'd be happy to provide that to you.
Well, as a follow-up to your question, Senator Brzezinski, I'm going to ask Dan about the this ordinance from the city of Ashland, and do you know, has that been used successfully? And you know, I have solar panels on my house, and we have neighbors that have trees, and we talk to them about making sure that they're trimming their trees, but that's a good question on whether as a homeowner there would be protection.
Chair Dingfelder, I can't speak to how well the ordinance in Ashland has worked. I do know that it's something that they developed, and they certainly take ownership and pride over the ordinance.
Okay. Well, maybe both of you could do some research and get back to the committee. That would be helpful.
But Madam Chair, you know, it's interesting. The state actually has, if I'm not mistaken, solar credits for people to take these type of steps.
Mm-hmm.
there's no safeguards or protection that once we give a credit, someone invests in it, that their neighbor doesn't basically trump us and our intent to promote that type of, let's say, conservation and production of power.
Not at the state level. It's designated to, what it appears is designated to, since the existing law says may.
Yeah, but I mean, we're giving credits out. Yep.
For what purpose?
Okay, thank you both.
Thank you.
Art Schlack and John Chandler. Anybody else would like to come up and testify in this bill? Okay. Got to watch the company you're keeping.
Yes,
share between the two of you. Madam Chair.
Which one are you talking to? Do I have to watch him or he watches me?
Both of you. Who wants to go first?
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Art Schlack with the Association of Oregon Counties. Here to express concerns about Senate Bill 675. And you've heard some of the concerns that I would express, so I don't want to belabor those from the previous two speakers. Needless to say, current statute is permissive with respect to counties' adoption of solar ordinances. This would put it into a mandatory situation, and I have a request out to counties right now to find out how many have adopted solar ordinances to date. I would offer to you that my what I think is probably less than this handful in terms of the counties that have undertaken this type of activity. So certainly we have a great concern about the budgetary impact to counties given our financial situation, and you've heard that, and I won't use the other term that is so often used on requirements at the local level where we don't have budgetary considerations. The other thing I would want to point out here is that not only do we talk about adopting an ordinance at this point to guide solar activities and facilities at this point, but we take another step in terms of enforcement, and that the county governing body shall provide protection for existing solar devices, and it goes on into enforcement. And this is a very delicate matter at this point. Any kind of enforcement at the local level, you want to first consider the ordinances that you're going to adopt and the regulations you're going to adopt, and really seriously consider how you're going to enforce those. And given counties and the county geography and the fact that we have lots of rural areas, there are lots of trees. There are a number of kinds of things that might interfere, but with solar access depending on the positioning of buildings. And to think that counties are going to be required to do tree ordinances or other kinds of things, I guess, is a reach at this point. Most solar ordinances that I've been had experience with have been in urban areas. But I would just note that even in urban areas, and when we look at densifying, that you could have a one-story house, put a solar panel on a roof, and then have, a couple of years later, an apartment building mm-hmm. built next door, consistent with all the regulations at this point that could cast a limitation, shall we say, on the adjacent solar panel at this point. So this is something that I think is going to evolve, but I think the enforcement that is called for here, at least the way I read the bill, is a very big challenge for local government, especially counties. Thank you very much.
John?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler with the Oregon Home Builders Association, and there's I've noticed more than once this session, there's limitation on the sign-up sheets. There should be a category for be careful in addition to support or oppose.
We'll be right on it.
With regard to Senate Bill 675, I don't necessarily disagree with the policy idea behind it, but it is very, very difficult to do. The permissive language in the statute, I think, has worked pretty well so far. And I remember back a bunch of years ago when I was working for the Portland Home Builders and I was dealing with the local government in the metro area, which had a very fierce tree ordinance and a very fierce solar ordinance and a very fierce setback ordinance for how structures were placed on the lot. And we ran into time after time after time when you simply couldn't meet all three, almost never could meet all three, oftentimes couldn't meet two of the three, and we finally had to have a meeting with the mayor and the department heads and basically said, pick. These are all valid public policies. Solar is an extraordinarily good public policy. Tree protection is an extraordinarily good public policy. Density and urban design is an extraordinarily good public policy. It is also extraordinarily difficult to get all three of them to match up. And when you start mandating, as this bill would do, turning a may to a shall, you've just upped the ante significantly for local governments. We're trying to have a very difficult balancing test under our land use system now for density and tight urban growth boundaries and sound urban design, which is going to make it very controversial with regard to solar. Because it's tough to do solar in a dense environment without extraordinarily well thought through subdivision design. The way this is drafted, you're coming into the middle of existing subdivisions. As a specific, if the bill moves, I'd want to talk about an amendment to exempt out anything currently platted, just because otherwise the solar installation on a lot A trumps the development on lot B in existing subdivisions. That can be problematic. But you're asking the cities and counties to do something that's very, very complicated and very difficult to do. They currently have the ability to do it. The cities and counties who want to, who have the interest, and have, more importantly, the local support to do so, are. To ask them to tell them they have to do it and have to look at things like lot patterns, have to look at things like street configurations and other things that are very controversial, very difficult, very expensive, that's where the be careful comes in. I really think that this is an issue best left at the local level, best left for decision-making at the local level, and the fist fights and arguments and the picking of public policy choices at the local level. Again, we support solar development. A lot of my members put it in. More would like to. We're very supportive of the direction that's going. We also understand that it can be very problematic in the implementation when it becomes mandatory in absence of those kind of detailed discussions. Last thing I want to mention, Madam Chair, in terms of if the bill moves, the language in the statute now about building orientation and lot patterns is something that I'd ask you to pay a lot of attention to with regard to solar, because most of our subdivisions, most of our land use assumptions now were not made with solar as one of the criteria. Our lot orientation pattern, our lot structures are usually based on transportation issues, on topography, on drainage, that sort of thing. They're not based on orienting the houses for the maximum ability to access solar. Maybe they should be. That's a significant lift for local governments, a significant lift for my folks to start redoing their plans in that way. It will have density implications. And from on the one hand, we're hardly ever coming in here saying, please don't move urban growth boundaries. So on the, if this bill had the effect of making it more likely we'd have to add land, we might not object to that. I doubt that's where you want to go, and certainly that's something that you would want to think through before you move the bill forward. But glad to take questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Prusansky.
So, question I'll ask for both of you. Since the state does give tax credits and there's really no safeguard for the investor, should the state get out of the business of giving tax credits for these, that they don't have any type of, protections for the investments that we're making?
Senator Prusansky, or Chair Dingfeller, Senator Prusansky, I think that, with anything, you can't assure 100%. And I think the benefits of the, if you will, the credits for other types of energy at this point outweigh maybe a few situations where you may have some conflicts that would create problems. So I think the state's much farther ahead doing what we're doing at this point and dealing with situations on a case-by-case basis as they that come up in local jurisdictions at this point. Part of this is just good relationships with your neighbors and those kinds of things.
Madam Chair, Senator Prusansky, if I might, with regard to the tax credit, tempting though it is to wade in the middle of that one, I'll pass. I do think the policy you're pointing at, though, using tax credits as a way of getting to it, when solar or any other sort of alternative energy production is a one-off and is occasional, you don't get the potential for grinding noises at the local level of policy choices that you would when it becomes a mandate or becomes more an emphasis of state focus. It's been a concern of ours, particularly over the summer and some of the other discussions were taking place with regard to solar, that it does, by definition, if you're going to go to a heavily, if the state's focus is going to be on solar, whether through tax credits or otherwise, then by definition you almost have to look at enforcement, at lot patterns, at subdivision structure, at density, at tree cover, and so on and so forth. And we've we don't have an opinion on that necessarily because the conversation hasn't really engaged as to all those different moving parts. We simply tried, and I mentioned here, there are moving parts. It's not as simple as simply protecting solar, because that doesn't have implications. If you protect, if you don't allow the tree or you move the building or you do something else, you have other public policy implications, all of which may be fine. But just to start with the notion that we're going to protect solar, absent those other conversations, is where we get nervous.
I understand that. So the other question I'd have is maybe in the sense of if there was going to be some type of enforcement where someone has that type of investment, maybe if there's going to be a competing use that's going to be permitted, there should be mitigation for the person that's losing out in the sense of offsets for the whatever energy they may no longer be able to gather because now there's either vegetation or a structure that is blocking it. Do you think that would be a means to, let's say, not protect, but to allow an individual to have some type of offset for the value they've lost?
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, so let me make sure I understand the question before I turf it to Mr. Schlack. I have a solar panel on my house, and my neighbor proposes a use or plants a tree or something else that would then block my solar panel. The mitigation would be from whom to what, to whom for how much?
Well, I don't know. That's what I'm asking.
Ah.
I mean, it would be basically, it seems to me that if someone is going to get a higher use of that property, that's going to impact the neighbor's current use, existing use, before the other goes into effect, before it was plotted, if it was a structure, that now that neighbor has lost that right that they had at one point to another competing right or interest.
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, at the risk of you noticing, I'm going to dodge two of your questions in a row here.
I know that.
Dang it, I probably shouldn't have mentioned that, huh? I think you just put your finger on the point I was trying to make, that this is best left at the local level. If we're going to have those kind of trade-off discussions where my right to build what I'm zoned for, bought the lot, intended to do, had the ability to do when I purchased it, is now going to be able to be affected by the way the bill's worded. It says built after, not purchased after. So I bought it. I now have to pay my neighbor so I don't block him. You just created a heck of a mess, potentially, and certainly one that ought to be thought through very carefully. As I said, I think the idea of pushing solar is something the state's going to have to get serious about, the nation's going to have to get serious about if we're going to get serious about alternative energy, but it isn't a free good in either sense of the economics of putting in the panels or the policy implications. And there may be those kind of discussions, but that's not something the state of Oregon ought to presume, I would submit to you. I think that's left to the local governments who have the ability to have those hearings, those discussions, and frankly take the hearing rooms full of people who are agitated about it.
You were successful. Dodging. Go ahead.
Years of practice.
Yeah. I know this.
Years and years of practice.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, I'd love to do a soft shoe and also skirt that one. But let me just say that, you know, in order to, I guess, start thinking about what you've are suggesting, we have to say, okay, well, where would that pot of money come if it's going to be a financial compensation at this point? Where would that come from, and who would provide that? Would it be the adjacent property owners? Would it be the local government? Where would it come from? And I guess if I start going down that trail, I would say that, you know, we'd have a whole lot of other kinds of other interesting issues that might want to go down that same trail. And let me give you the one example that came to my mind right away, and that was, I've got a house with a wonderful view and vista. And it's there, and boy, if I put my house on the market today, it would get a top dollar. But my neighbor, or the vacant property next to me, they decide to build, and they build a house, and my view and vista is gone. And so I no longer have what I thought I had and the value I have. So it's kind of, maybe it's not exactly the same, but it's kind of in the same vein as to how do you assure that some of these values that people have and are going to be there. I'm not sure that we can make all those assurances and, again, develop the communities in a balanced way, the way we're headed to do, especially in urban areas, because we just can't meet all the goals and that everybody has all the time.
Okay, John, last word.
Madam Chair, Senator Vronsky, let me take one more run at your question, because I think Mr. Slack just made a good point. The one very simple way to accomplish what this bill is intending is to go to larger lots. And I'm not being facetious. There is a way. We've always historically taken the position that if you want to protect your view shed, you should buy the lot next to you.
No, that view isn't what we're talking about.
I know, but the theory is the same. If you want to, if I want to access the sun, then I can either make sure I do by purchasing land around me sufficient and have a big enough lot to where no one can block it save me. Where you get into trouble is where you have adjoining property owners who have a right or thought they did, or the city's policies for density or for type of housing or structure, height, or what have you. That's where you run into the problem. I'm not being deliberately facetious at all. There is a way to do it. It simply runs into other social goals that are equally legitimate. That's why my point is it is not as susceptible to state requirements as it would be to local decision-making.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And I think we'll look forward to getting some information back from my city and from the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties on this. Anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? Senate Bill 675. Okay, now he's leaving. He doesn't want to testify. All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 675. I'm going to move into work session now, and I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 191. Beth, if you could...
That's set over, 191, you said.
No, not 191. We're having
194.
Yeah, 193 and 194. Beth, if you can review 191, please.
Yes. Senate Bill 191 adds exemption from surface mining regulation requirements for lands within the surfaces and contours of surface mine in existence on July 1st, 1972, as long as they meet certain requirements. It also authorizes the department to allow a surface mining operation that held a valid county operating permit and reclamation plan to continue for no more than 1 year, as long as the operator applies for a permit within 60 days of the zoning ordinance repeal becoming effective. There is an amendment that's in front of the committee and also in the back of the room. It's the -1 amendment. It requires that the application for a certificate of exemption be filed with the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries within 90 days of the county's repeal of a zoning law or ordinances taking effect. It would also require that if the department does not approve or disapprove of the application within 90 days of it being filed, it would be automatically deemed approved. Just also for the record, Columbia County... who is the one county who is still operating their own permit program, who came to testify, submitted a letter in support of the -1 amendments. Also, Gary Lynch is here.
Okay, Gary, why don't you come up?
And just while he's coming up, there is a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued on it.
Okay, Gary, do you want to add anything to the discussion about the -1 amendments?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Gary Lynch, Doug Amy, Assistant Director. No, and everybody is in support of this. It is a clarification. This is the last county to come. And it basically holds the agency's feet to the fire. We have to make the 7 of these sites in Columbia County that this would apply to. And this will make it so that they have a time frame within which they have to apply, and we have a time frame, similar time frame, within which we have to get back to them with an answer or it's automatically approved.
Okay. Thank you, Gary. Okay, with that, we're in a work session. I will accept a motion.
The -1.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves to adopt the -1 amendments dated March 12, 2009. Is there any discussion? Okay. Any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 191 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 191 to the floor as amended with the -1s with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Okay, seeing none, motion passes, and I will carry this to the floor. Okay, with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 191, open up a work session on Senate Bill 599. Beth?
Chair Dingfelder and Committee, Senate Bill 599 modifies the definition of surface mining. There is an amendment in front of you that basically it changes the wording to clarify that the exclusion of grading operations is only within or adjacent to the highway right-of-way. It also changes the term from the previously in the bill we used public transportation facility to highway, and then it provides a statutory reference to that definition.
Okay. Gary, you're right in the right position. So you want to...
Again, Madam Chair, for the record, Gary Lynch, Assistant Director at Dagami. Again, a clarification. This is really a bill to make sure that ODOT, county highway road departments or city road departments don't have to get a Dagami permit when they're working within the road right of way. It was inadvertent that it came out the way it did, thanks to Beth and a lot of other people making defining what a road is. We had that definition finally. I thought I knew what it was till, but anyway. So this is again a good clarification, and it's supported by everybody that I've talked to.
Thank you.
And also, sorry, just for the record, there's a no revenue impact.
Okay. I was just going to ask that, but I have the sheet here. Okay. So we're in work session. I will accept a motion.
Would you like the dash one amendment?
Sure would.
To the Okapa Dogami MRRFQ PDQ. I would move the dash ones, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Atkinson moves to adopt the dash one amendments with lots of acronyms. Dated March 24th, 2009. Is there any discussion?
It's good that ODOT is on board.
No discussion. Any objections?
That's ODOT. ODOT.
No objections. The motion carries.
I would move this lovely bill that clarifies the clarification as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Atkinson moves 599. Senate Bill 599 is amended with the dash ones to the floor with the due pass recommendations. Is there any discussion? Okay. Any objections? Seeing none, the motion passes. And Senator Atkinson, I'm going to ask you.
Absolutely.
All of that. He deserves it.
To carry this bill.
The union is safe.
Okay. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 599. And Beth, any announcements for our next meeting?
No, we did actually we reissued the agenda with Senate Bill 79 with a new amendment for that. And we sent it out for our distribution. So everyone that received our agenda will also receive the amendment, and then it was sent to all of your emails. So.
Okay, thank you for that reminder. So I will ask the committee members to please make sure and read the amendment to Senate Bill 79. Just a reminder, we had two work groups that were meeting. Beth did an excellent job at organizing both of those. This is a consensus amendment that's coming forward, and I would ask you to read it before the work session on Thursday, and we'll be hearing more about it then. With that, we'll close the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources.